I could not see Amy Brock's face when she finished her splendid scripture reading this morning, but I could see Matthew Milton's face because he walked by me on the way out. He had not revealed to you any emotion, but as he came by me, there was a slight, very slight smile of satisfaction. I think he had looked upon his performance and pronounced it good. As in fact it was. We have more visitors this morning than I can list for you, but every single one of them is warmly welcome in this place. We're glad you're here. We're finishing this morning a group of three sermons on how important it is to have a healthy, vivid imagination. If you want loyal friends, if you want an exciting life, inside your own mind, if you want a good worship experience when you come to church on Sunday. Imagination is a special kind of seeing, and this final sermon invites you to take the time to look in that particular way. We have analyzed and quoted. Today we'll listen to the storytellers. The play is called The Rainmaker. There is a girl in it named Lizzie, who in a moment of the most tender trust says this about her father to a man who has won her confidence. Some nights I'm in the kitchen washing the dishes and Pop's playing poker with the boys. Well, I'll watch him real close, and at first I'll just see an ordinary middle-aged man, not very interesting to look at. And then, minute by minute, I'll see little things I never saw in him before. Good things and bad things. Strange little habits I never noticed he had. And ways of talking I never paid any mind to. And suddenly, I know who he is. And I love him so much, I could cry. And I want to thank God I took the time to see him real. Wives and husbands sit in the same room for months and years and do not see each other. It's a moment of magic when parents and children notice what a thick film of familiarity had kept hidden from them. That kind of seeing is possible only by means of the faculty we call the imagination. Here is a true story about a teacher who lacked imagination and a black child named Tommy who comes into class one morning wearing a cap. Since the rule says no caps in the classroom, and since Tommy has given some trouble before, the teacher has two options. He can ask Tommy, is there a reason for the cap? Which you remember, I'm sure, is a violation of the rules. And give the child a chance to explain. Or he can decide that the child is only making trouble again. And in front of everyone, with some legitimate irritation, he can bark, all right, Tommy, off with the cap. Right now. He chooses to do the second. The kids fall silent, as they tend to do when one of them is in trouble, and they turn to watch. Tommy looks at the top of his desk for a long moment and then does an unusual and, for him, very painful thing. He says, please. Please what? Please let me keep it on today. Now, at that moment, a sensitive and imaginative person, they are the same thing, might decide that behind this rare courtesy lay some urgent need, and that perhaps it should be handled privately. But this teacher, although he had the time, lacked the imagination, so he snapped, "Take it off, or I'll take it off for you." So with no choice, Tommy reaches up and pulls off his cap with excruciating embarrassment, because his parents had shaved his head the night before, and he hated the sight of his peeled skull so much, he would have done anything to hide it. The class giggled, as he knew it would, and if his handsome face had not been black, they would have seen him blush scarlet with humiliation. After class is over, you walk up to the teacher, whom you've been observing, and you say, "I suppose when you saw what he was trying to hide, you rather wished you had let him wear the cap for a day or two." And the teacher says, "Not on your life. He just likes to play cute. I can't imagine why a haircut has to bother someone so much." It wasn't a haircut. It was a scalp job. But part of what the teacher says is true. He can't imagine. He can't be that child, even for a moment. He can't recreate for himself the night before, when the parents insisted on the economical thing to do, even over their son's tearful protests. He can't travel with the child on the bus while someone yanks off the cap and everybody howls with laughter. He can't beat with Tommy's heart when he walks into class wondering if they too will laugh at him. It does not occur to him to wonder how he would feel if he were about to stand for an introduction at the big national convention and some practical joker snatched off his new hairpiece and held it up to the crowd. If he could imagine that and then transfer the feeling to the child, but as he said, he cannot imagine. And so he rolls through every crisis without an ounce of identification. Tommy is not his child, nor someone else's child, nor even a person. He is a problem. And the response to him has already become a stock response. In human relationships, there is no uglier term. Stock response. The automatic reaction, untouched by imagination. My older son and I were talking about this one night, and he recalled for me the most painful moment he could remember from the third grade in Riverside Elementary. He'd written a note to a girl named Rosemary to ask if she loved him. He must have been doubtful, even that she would condescend to reply, because he made it as easy for her as he could. He drew two boxes, one marked yes and the other no, and asked her to please check one. The teacher intercepted his note, held it up to the class, and said, "Robin, would you like for me to read this to everyone?" He said, "Please don't read it," and his eyes filled with tears. So she unfolded the note and very deliberately read it to the class. The punishment was out of proportion to the crime. The woman had no imagination. No one should teach children who lacks imagination. If I had the power and knew how to make up the test, I would insist that teachers pass the imagination test before they enter the classroom. I'd rather have them make a mistake in history or geography or English. I know why imagination gets put on the shelf. Sometimes, even by those who have it, it costs too much. Sherwood Anderson, who taught writers of fiction in this country so much, wrote to a friend once, "You have to pay dearly for being an imaginative person. You see a great deal and feel a great deal, but there is ugliness to see and feel as well as beauty, and in yourself as well as in the others." He's right, of course, not only about imagination, but about every other gift that you can think of. You have to pay for it. If it's imagination, it will cost you great anguish. Sometimes, and in those moments, you will wish to be dull. But it will at other times fill you with such radiant joy that you will thank God for the gift. Let's see how it works one more time. In a story you've heard, this one from Thornton Wilder's famous play, Our Town, in which he takes a loving look at the daily life of a small New England village called Grover's Corners that must have had a church in it that looked just like this one. We live through a day in the homes of two or three families, watching the age-old rituals of love and courtship, marriage. In the last act, the young wife, Emily Gibbs, dies at the birth of her second child and joins the other dead in the town cemetery. They sit on wooden chairs, lined up in rows on the stage, and as they talk with one another, we feel their growing detachment from their life on earth. Suddenly, Emily breaks in on their talk with her own agonized realization that living people do not see one another, that in a way they are shut up in little boxes. A vast universe is spread out before them, but they see only what is in their little boxes. They forget that time is not endless, and in their preoccupations, they lose utterly moments which can never come back to them. Wilder tries to show this by having Emily decide after 14 years in heaven that she'd like to go back and live part of her life over. The stage manager warns her against trying this. He says some have done it, but they've always come quickly back and not chosen to try that again. Emily insists, however, that she will choose a happy day, her 12th birthday, and the stage manager makes the necessary arrangements. She can have that whole day on earth again with her family, living it exactly as she lived it years before. The only difference will be that she will watch her former self and family with the eyes of her new self, and she will see what she could not see then. When she arrives to take her place, Her father is busy with his work, her mother with hers, as people have to be. Her mother calls upstairs to Emily's brother, Wally, kisses Emily a bit absent-mindedly. She had, after all, kissed her yesterday, and she would kiss her tomorrow. And she frets a little about how her daughter eats breakfast and whether she chews her bacon slowly. This is a normal day for her. Emily is alive, and as far as her mother knows, she'll be alive long after the mother is dead. She tells Emily that there is a present for her from her aunt and a postcard album from a boy named George Gibbs, who must have brought it over very early because it was on the doorstep with the milk. Emily is deeply moved as she picks up the album, and suddenly she realizes that she cannot stand this new knowledge of the way people live in the same house, so unaware of time and so seldom really seeing each other. She whispers to the stage manager that she cannot go on, but she can't resist turning to plead with her mother to see her through the haze of routine. Because it is a dream sequence, her mother can't hear what she is saying and goes on stirring the oatmeal while Emily begs her to savor the moment. Oh, Mama, just look at me. 1 minute, as though you really saw me. Mama, 14 years have gone by. I'm dead. You're a grandmother, Mama. I married George Gibbs. She thinks of her brother, whom her mother had just called, and she remembers what later happened to him. Wally's dead, too, Mama. His appendix burst on a camping trip to North Conway. We felt just terrible about it, don't you remember? But just for a moment, now, we're all together. Mama, just for a moment, we're happy. Let's look at one another. Emily turns to the stage manager and cries out that life goes too fast. We don't have time to look at one another. She asks to be taken back. But before she leaves for the last time, she wants to say goodbye to things she has not seen clearly enough herself, to ordinary, simple things that are taken for granted until one no longer has them. Goodbye, she says. Goodbye to clocks ticking, and Mama's sunflowers, and food, and coffee, and new ironed dresses, and hot baths, and sleeping, and waking up. She has a final question for the stage manager. Do any human beings ever realize life while they live it? Every minute. He says, no. Pauses for a moment and then adds, the saints and poets, maybe. They do, some. I like that coupling, the saints and poets. The ones who have in common a great gift of imagination. The ones who take time to look. The saints see a God who is unseen, They glimpse an invisible kingdom. The poets, like Wilder, create an our town which never existed except in imagination, but is made so real for us that when we see it on stage, our imagination stirs and stretches, and we know for a moment or so how we ought to live. We know that when Jesus said that the first and greatest commandment was love, what he meant was, take time to look at one another.